Good morning. It's Saturday, July 5th, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM WOMMLP in Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, your host for Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a conversation with Philip Baruth. Philip is a novelist, a blogger, and a regular commentator for Vermont Public Radio. His commentaries have earned him Vermont Associated Press Awards and a National Public Radio News Directors Award. Philip's blog, the Vermont Daily Briefing, was voted Best Vermont Blog in 2006 by the readers of 7 Days and Best Political Vermont Blog in 2007. The New York Times selected his novel, The Ex-President, as a notable book of 2003. The Washington Post has described Philip as one of the newer, new generation of up-and-coming writers. He lives in Burlington, Vermont, and has taught at the University of Vermont since 1993. In addition to fiction, he publishes nonfiction essays and scholarship on 18th-century British literature. His next novel, The Brothers Boswell, due out in the spring of 2009 from Soho Press, is a literary thriller tracing the famous friendship between James Boswell and Samuel Johnson, author of the first modern dictionary. When I interviewed Philip in May, I began by asking what had inspired him to write The Ex-President.
Well, in 1992, I voted for a Democrat, and the Democrat won, which I had no experience with before. I had always voted for losers before that. And when Bill Clinton won, I was at a victory party with air quotes around it, because Democrats always had quote-unquote victory parties that actually turned into wakes. And so we were having our normal victory party, and it actually turned into a victory party where the Democrat won. And all of us were sort of stunned. We didn't know how to celebrate, really. And then as his presidency began to gather steam, I realized that we were dealing with, you know, someone with very deep roots in the Democratic Party, but with a very different vision for it. And I started to try to figure out if that vision comported with my ideas of what being a Democrat was, but also whether that was what made him a winner, his ideological positions, or was it his personality and his obvious talents as a campaigner. So I just started to read about Bill Clinton, and I would say conservatively I've read about 40 books about him at this point. I don't know if I've read that many books about anybody. Mm-hmm. And all that material started to back up in my mind to the point where I had to do something with it. And so I had the idea that I'd like to write a book about Bill Clinton. And there's a great biography of Clinton by David Moranis called First in His Class, one of the best biographies I've ever read. And it takes Clinton from the time he's about, well, from his birth, but it really picks up when he's 16 and he goes to visit the White House with Boys Nation. And the busload of them pulls in and they all run to the Rose Garden, and there they meet JFK. And there's a very famous photo that's taken of Clinton shaking JFK's hand. And when Clinton runs for the White House, that photo becomes a kind of proof somehow that he touched destiny and that the sword was passed somehow. So when I read that biography, I thought I'd really love to write a novel that encompasses that moment and that young Bill Clinton. At the same time, I wanted to deal with his presidency. So at first I was thinking, well, I'll have, you know, a story that begins when he's 16 and continues in the traditional way until he's president. But then I began to kick around another idea for a sort of futuristic book that would involve something I called the cigarette wars. So you remember the tobacco settlement during the Clinton mm-hmm. years. And basically what that was very good in many ways, but it was a green light to multinational tobacco interests to go to the third world. And there was even language allowing a sort of synergy between the government and these corporations in terms of capturing market share in the third world. So I thought, what if our tobacco settlement, that is when the government sued the tobacco companies, what if that happens at the world level? Because it seems an obvious development if you give it 30 or 40 years and you have hundreds of millions of people dying of cancer in these countries. And you have also the precedent of the U.S. tobacco settlement as precedent for that legal case. So then I started to imagine a situation where the rest of the world sues the U.S., wins, and the U.S. refuses to pay. And then I began to imagine a third temporal dimension where the 109-year-old Bill Clinton is looking back on this tobacco settlement and realizing that it kicked off World War III. Mm-hmm. So when I put all those three things together, I had a three-tiered character of Bill Clinton that hopefully would allow people to get outside the Bill Clinton they thought they knew and into a new, completely new way of looking at someone that they see every day. The only way to connect those, I thought, was time travel.
Right.
So time travel was a necessity, not a choice.
Was that a little bit intimidating to
yes.
you? Because it's so, I don't know, so genre-specific, I suppose, as
yes,
a writer.
Exactly. And it was intimidating, but not at all because I don't like science fiction, because I do. I love it. And I read a lot of it growing up. And I think, ultimately, that's why I came to that solution to the problem. But the reason it was intimidating is that I knew immediately that it would make selling the book next to impossible. Because having read it, you know, it's got a lot of deep politics in it. So I was really shooting for political junkies. Political junkies and science fiction junkies, there is some overlap there, but not a great deal.
Mm-hmm.
So I would hear back from mainstream publishers that they wanted less science fiction. And I would hear back from science fiction publishers that we needed to axe all of this politics.
Mm-hmm.
And occasionally, very occasionally, somebody would express delight that the two had been brought together, but say there's no way we could market it. And then finally, after a long bout of searching, Bantam Books, a couple of editors there really liked the two things together, even though they thought, you know, clearly this is going to go to a smaller audience, but we're fine with targeting that audience.
Right, but Bantam's great. I mean, that must have been an extraordinary happy day.
I was jumping up and down, basically.
That's great. I want to read a quote from the book. "Sometimes a grudge is all the relief you can get from some people." And that's a line from the narrator, Sal's Aunt Mary. I guess I'm jumping ahead a little bit here because we haven't really talked about who all these characters are. But Sal's Aunt Mary is talking about Sal's father. And in the context of this question, I suppose it's not very important. But the next line reminds us of someone else. It reminded me of someone else. "He's the kind to do something hurtful and then wait to be forgiven. And then he'll do it all over again."
Mm.
And I was curious if you intentionally set up Sal's father to kind of mirror BC's personality. I enjoyed that, and I'm just wondering, as a writer, why you felt that that was something that would be useful to do.
Yeah, I guess in a certain way what I'm trying to do is produce a mirroring all the way through the book. So just to set it up for people who haven't read the book, Sal Hayden is the narrator of the book. She's the official biographer of BC in 2055.
Mm-hmm.
So she knows more about Bill Clinton than anyone living. In fact, she knows more about Bill Clinton than anyone dead, too, because she goes back in time eventually. So she understands the whole of his life in ways that his mother, for instance, even couldn't. So what eventually happens is that in order to prevent World War III, they decide they need to convince Bill Clinton when he's president not to launch these various initiatives that lead to World War III. The only way to do that in the book's sort of wild high concept is to take the young Bill Clinton when he's 16 to meet himself in 1995, because that's the only proof they can offer that this ruins the future, is if he meets himself.
Mm-hmm.
So they have a team of time-traveling NSA operatives who are supposed to do this. And behind it all is a group called Group Storyboard. And it's a very secret government organization that designs this whole project, this whole secret black operation. And eventually Sal learns that these people studied the psychodynamics of Bill Clinton's life. And so what they've done is they've deliberately picked a person to lead this team, whose code name is James Carville, who will be very much like the kind of bullying older men that Bill Clinton always felt he had to save his mother from when he was growing up, So they're playing on his psychological weaknesses. They also know that Bill Clinton is particularly susceptible in one way to attractive young women, so they have one of those along, a woman named Virginia, who happens to also be a Green Beret. And then they know that he's very susceptible to trying to please older women who remind him of his grandmother. So Sal, in a thing that really infuriates her, she's being cast as Bill Clinton's grandmother in this little group that they've put together. Now
at the age of
I think she's in her
40, right?
Yeah, something like that. but she's the older woman compared to Virginia. So at the deepest level, I think what Sal realizes is that she is attracted to Bill Clinton as a figure of biography. In other words, she chose to write his biography because she shares some of these same predispositions with regard to people that remind her of her father. So all the way through, everybody is being motivated by the same sorts of psychological lacks and absences, and it revolves around fathers for both of them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Before we go any further, why don't you read a little bit of the book?
Sure.
So I'll just say this is Philippa Ruth reading from The Ex-President, which is published by Bantam and came out 2003.
So just to set this up, Sal, for years, has been interviewing the 109-year-old Bill Clinton and compiling all the material as well as turning it out as a fully written biography. And once she understands that the plot that the NSA has worked out revolves around time travel, because they sort of Shanghai her into it, she doesn't realize she's going to get into a ship that's going to travel to another time. When she does, they trick her. And once she's been tricked and she understands what's been done to her, she begins to look at the concept of time travel and think about it in different ways. And she actually comes to look at the 2000 election, that weird contested election where we all woke up and there wasn't a president, and for a month we didn't have a president. She starts to look at that as time travel of a very curious sort. So this is Sal sort of discussing her thoughts about Bill Clinton and that election. One afternoon I asked BC what event had caused him the greatest pain in public life. It was the sort of prying, marginally prurient question he most hated, and the sort I usually avoided for reasons having nothing to do with BC. It seemed to me more a talk show host's question than a biographer's, and it still does. But maybe it was payback. The first 2 hours of that day's interview had been more than a little much, with BC off on an unabashedly egocentric tear, making a case for himself as the peacemaker president, the economic steward, the president of racial healing. He'd reminded me twice about winning the Charlemagne Prize for contributing to peace in Europe. Maybe the question was my way of reminding him that I was an independent biographer, not a temp in the White House PR office. In any event, I asked it. His face clouded over slightly, his bushy brows drawing together, the wrinkled skin of his forehead drew taut. He got tight-lipped, and for a second I thought he might have an outburst. He didn't have them often with me, but he had them, and often it was something unexpected that brought them on. But BC bit his lip, and then he answered, the watery blue eyes linking up with mine. You might think it'd be the whole scandal business, Sal. Businesses, better call it, since so many people made a career out of it. Impeachment, all that. I could tell it took real effort for him to say the word impeachment out loud. He looked into the fireplace, brooding. And that was painful, I tell you. Awful painful, truly awful. But you know, when you look back, there's other things, more fundamental stuff, stuff you can't get your mind off of. And then he just said it. It was when the American people voted in George W. Bush for president in 2000, voted in junior. They didn't do it by much, God knows, lost the popular vote. Something like 600 votes in Florida was about all his mandate was, if you can call it that. But they did it. They put that zero in office. That hurt the worst. Because Bush wasn't qualified to be president, had 5 years in as governor of Texas, and that was a state at the time with the weakest gubernatorial powers going. He was, they said it at the time, but he was nothing but an empty suit, and I met him and talked to him, I know. But still, the American people put him into the Oval Office. He laid a finger alongside the immense nose, absently stroking the bulb of it, thinking. And then he looked up for support. And that hurt. At that time, I thought the answer was a bit of misdirection. Move the biographer off the sore spot and onto a prolonged discussion of an election in which BC himself wasn't even a candidate. But I understand it now, I think. The 2000 election wasn't about qualifications or issues or character or any of the other things normally thought to decide an election. It was about sending BC a message of displeasure, but a message of an amazing sort. It was about returning to a forked moment in history and choosing the fork untraveled. Here was George W. Bush, so much like a younger and more politically agile version of his father that he might have been genetically engineered, running against Al Gore, which is to say against the entire BC era. In the minds and the emotions of the voters, it was Bush versus BC, the 1992 election, all over again. And they chose Bush that time around, not by a landslide, not even by a clear plurality, but they chose him. It was like putting the whole BC era under a strange kind of erasure. That was what galled BC, what ailed him decades later, that the voters had gone back in time and re-voted the election that swept BC into the White House as the candidate of change. The 2000 election was about time travel, I realize.
Thank you. At one point in her narration, Sal makes the comment that BC was always something of a guilty pleasure for America. Mm. I love that line. I thought it was a really interesting way to look at his relationship with the country. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I really think that that's true. And all of this is going to be run, obviously, through the mill of the 2007 primary that we've just now come to the end to. 2007-2008 primary, Barack Obama versus Hillary Clinton, with Bill Clinton very much in the foreground, not in the background. To go back to 1992, when we voted in November of that year, we knew a lot of things about Bill Clinton. We knew that he had almost certainly had multiple affairs. We knew that he was going to be prone to misrepresenting those affairs, if not lying about them. And yet, what we wanted was somebody to fix the economy, as he put it, to focus on the economy like a laser. And we wanted somebody who could, you know, the pat expression has become feel our pain. But I think instead what Bill Clinton was able to do is he was able to give people the distinct impression that he was listening to them and that he would channel what they had to say into public policy. And for large parts of his presidency, I think you can make the case that he did that. You know, the economy turned around dramatically, partially, arguably, on the basis of policy positions that he made. But the things that we knew about him continued to be very deep and deeply troubling things all the way through his presidency. So Monica Lewinsky was perfectly prefigured in Jennifer Flowers and Paula Jones. Exactly the same thing. And everyone arguably knew what they were getting into when they voted for Bill Clinton and when they re-voted in 1996 to put him back in the White House. So at that point, I think we had it in the back of our minds that this was true. But as Democrats, at least, we didn't want to admit it. Republicans obviously shouted it from the rooftops and tried to get everybody to see, hey, this is a guy who's, you know, not walking the straight and narrow. Can we talk about that? Only after Monica Lewinsky comes into the public eye do we actually, as a nation, have to confront the good and the bad about Bill Clinton. And is it worth it? And 60% or so of the people decided during the impeachment debacle that it was. And they kept him in the White House, that two-thirds of America that said the guilty pleasures of Bill Clinton and the policy that he's willing to continue to work for are worth all the rest of it. Mm-hmm. But I think, finally, Hillary Clinton's chances at the White House were effectively torpedoed by that same guilty pleasure, because mm-hmm. people are not going to want to see it run through again, I don't think.
Right. And through her, in whom we would actually be investing our attention.
But with the idea that Bill Clinton, you know, as we've seen in the primary season, he's not constitutionally able to remain in the background. Mm-hmm. It's not part of his personality. And so, you know, what was at one point attractive about him, I think, ceased to be for many people. And so when he began to take the spotlight away from her, it had a really devastating effect on her candidacy, I think.
Did you send him a copy of this book?
I didn't, but there's a guy who writes for USA Today, and I want to say Walter Shapiro, but I might have it wrong. I'm pretty sure it's Walter Shapiro. He wrote a book called One Car Caravan, and he came to Burlington. And I was there, and I was going to give him a copy of my book because I knew that he had written a lot about Bill Clinton. And he already had a copy that had been given to him by somebody who was an ambassador under Bill Clinton. And that person said he had given that copy to Clinton, and Clinton had read it and given it back to him.
Oh, wow.
So I don't know that that's true, but I at least heard that he had...
It's a great story.
Read it. Yeah.
It's fun to think it might be true. From a writer's perspective, what are the chances of being sued? What are the liability issues when you write a fictional account of a public figure who's more or less part of the public domain?
Yep. It was surprisingly problematic.
So, oh, really?
Yeah, when I was sending it out, I had some trouble even getting my agent to sign off on it. So he sent it out twice to an internal and an external lawyer. Then when Bantam wanted it, they wouldn't write a contract until it went through their lawyers. Then when I revised the manuscript, they sent it back through the lawyers. And then just before the book came out, when it was all together with, you know, the complete package of the cover and, you know, the copy as well as the text, everything had to go to the lawyers one more time because they were deeply paranoid that they would be sued about it. All five of those legal tests came back with the same answer, and that is Bill Clinton no longer has any character to assassinate. And so they figured that plus time travel, which cues people in that this is not meant to be taken as reality, that was enough to shield the book from liability. But, you know, when you think about it, Bill Clinton's DNA is available because of the Starr Report. You know, we don't need to go into why that DNA is available, but that's in the public record. So if you think about that, he's just been absolutely exposed as much as any human being possibly can.
Speaking of the time travel, how much of the science in this book is completely invented, and how much is the result of research about science that's in the works?
Yeah, there, usually science fiction people talk about hard science fiction and soft science fiction. Mine is like so soft it's almost talcum powder. There's basically no science behind the time travel. It's a sort of secret device that the NSA is never going to tell anybody about, no matter how much they want to know, which was my way of saying to the reader, look, don't look here for an explanation of time travel. Michael Crichton, you know, he has a book called Timeline where he does a very nice job of using quantum physics and other actual developments in science to explain how something like that might theoretically be possible. I was just interested in looking at the 16-year-old Bill Clinton and the 109-year-old
Bill
Clinton.
Right, and just getting them there.
Yeah.
There were some other things, kinetic interactive art, ultralight headphones, cyber library.
Yeah.
I mean, some of that stuff felt very possible.
Yep.
Did you make all that up?
Yeah, I made it all up, and you know, I think if you're going to write even near futurism, you have a responsibility as an artist to try to game out what's going to be the case in 20 years or 30 years. So one of the things I really like is my Burlington of 2055.
Very dark.
A little dark. And
I was depressed.
But it has whisper trams that run up and down College Hill. And I like the idea that we finally, after, you know, centuries, we get mass transit at least right. But yeah, there are other less flattering things about that picture of the future. It's dark in the sense that it's post 9/11, and it's very infused with surveillance paranoia. So the people in 2055 are being continually surveilled, and they're having their face and gestures scrutinized by computers at any public venue. And so that's one of the things that time travel gives Sal, is this perspective of, wow, when you go to 1963, there are no cameras watching you. And what an amazing difference that is.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about your blog a little bit.
Okay.
Your blog is called The Vermont Daily Briefing, and it's www.vermontdailybriefing.com, all spelled out. It was voted Best Vermont Blog in 2006 by the readers of 7 Days, and Best Vermont Political Blog again in 2007 by 7 Days. So that must feel great.
Yeah, I love that blog.
It's a great blog. It's fun to read, and you have the pictures and everything. So much fun. How many hours a week are you working on the blog?
Many more than I should be. Anybody who blogs regularly will tell you that it taps into a deeply unattractive exhibitionism somehow, so that you come in the morning and you have to say what you think for that particular day. And sometimes it feels like an obligation, but far more often it just strikes me as this wonderful tool to speak to people who have the same obsessions I do. Mm-hmm. That is, in this case, about politics, specifically Democratic politics, and how, you know, for the last 8 years, the Bush administration has systematically undercut constitutional liberties. Mm-hmm. And the America that I grew up with and want to pass to my kids. Mm-hmm. So having the ability to speak out on that every day, having committed readers who communicate with me about it, it's just been one of the delights of my life.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Philip Baruth. If you would like to hear a repeat of this week's show or tell a friend about it, I will be broadcasting it again next week a half an hour early at 9 a.m. And then at 9:30 you can tune in to hear the second half of the interview. I should say at this time that the views expressed here are solely those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of WOMMLP, its management board, or any of its affiliates. If you're interested in sharing Write the Book with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live every Saturday morning at www.theradiator.org. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes as free podcasts. If you have comments about the show or events for next week's Bookworms calendar, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM WOMMLP in Burlington, Vermont.